Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
If you were sitting next to me right now, here's what you'd see. A cramped radio studio with some mushy thingies attached to the wall and layers of glass between me and the rest of the office. This is the kind of room that I work in. Small, quiet, isolated. So it feels really, really different to tell a story in front of a live audience instead. People are looking right at you with their eyes. That setting creates a unique kind of electricity. And that's what we discovered when we partnered with the Seattle-based series Fresh Ground Stories to produce a live storytelling event. Today on Sound Effect, we are bringing you stories from that show. The theme was small miracles. And we begin with me.
So I'm about 8 years old, and I'm at the swimming pool at the Canton, Ohio Jewish Community Center, and I am lying face down in the water. Now, people aren't really freaking out or anything, because I'm not, like, drowning. This is the dead man float, and that is one of the core competencies of advanced beginners swim class, right? So you got your dead man's float, you got your elementary backstroke, your front crawl, and so on. You know, the beginners, that's more like holding on to the side of the pool and blowing bubbles, and I had aced that, so I was advanced now. So last day of the class, I finished up, and then we all climb out of the pool, and we all line up on the tiles next to the pool, standing there, our little 8-year-old body shivering, and wait for our Red Cross cards. Now, these are business card-sized things, the little Red Cross logo on it, and it's kind of like our diploma. These basically say the name of the class that we are graduating into. So I was there waiting for my card that said Intermediate, which was what came after Advanced Beginners and seemed very lofty to me at the time. So the instructor came up and handed me my card, and I looked down, and it said Advanced Beginners. So it appears that I flunked Advanced Beginners. So I came back, you know, the next camp session or whatever, and I went through the class again, and I did the dead man's float, and I did the front crawl, and I did the elementary backstroke, and we finished up, and we lined up, and I got my card, and it said Advanced Beginners again. So then it was time for me to take this class for a third time. And then there was a fourth time. And then there was a fifth time. And I'm getting just a stack of these Advanced Beginners cards, and it's just like this little tower to my incompetence. And you know, in the meantime, like, years are going by, right? The world is turning. My peers are passing me up. Some of them have, like, joined the swim team, which to me seemed crazy because those people get up at, like, 5 in the morning. And the other thing that's happening is that I'm, like, becoming a sort of pre-adolescent person. So my discomfort in the water is mixing in with my prepubescent body shame and my early stirrings of, you know, like the young male macho sports culture, which I just could not abide. And as I started to get into my teenage years, I decided, you know what, that's enough swimming for me, thank you very much. And while we're at it, let's get rid of all the other sports too. And instead, let's focus on things that we're good at and that mean a lot to me, that I care about. And so as a teenager, those things were primarily reading and smoking. And I'm a parent now, I don't do either of those things anymore. But I worked pretty hard at reading and smoking throughout my high school years, and I must have been pretty good at it, because by the time I graduated high school, I had gotten into a good college as an English major, and I was in terrible physical shape. So the summer before I went off to college, I spent that summer working the graveyard shift, waiting tables at Denny's. And so this was like a summer of nicotine and pancakes, and as you can imagine, you know, I was in top form by the fall, right? So fall rolls around. The week before classes start at college, there's a freshman orientation week. So I show up there with my little dorm room fridge and with my plug-in rice cooker, and I meet my roommate and I get acquainted with everybody. A few days in, I should mention something about the university that I went to. It has a strange graduation requirement. So Cornell University, in order to graduate, you have to take 2 credits of physical education classes. But they offer really cool PE classes. Like you can take backpacking and rock climbing and kayaking and stuff like that. And even though I couldn't stand competitive sports, I love the outdoors. So this seemed like some gym class that I could get behind, right? However, there was a catch. And the catch is that every incoming freshman had to take and pass a swim test. And if you did not pass the swim test, then you don't get to take spelunking or bowling or whatever. Instead, for your PE credit, you get to take swimming. And you get to take it for 2 semesters. So I set my sights on passing this swim test. This became my Everest. So anyway, back to freshman orientation week. I'm there. A few days in is the dreaded swim test. So I get up in the morning. I get prepared. I carbo load with that rice cooker. And I make my way up the hill toward the athletic building. And when I get there, the scene is like this. There's like an Olympic-sized pool, and at every lane there is a young man standing there waiting to jump in, and it's a gender-segregated swim test. And the thing is, people go in heats. So everybody would jump in at once. You'd do 3 laps, out, back, and out again, and then the next heat would go. And I'm noticing that these young men, there's a certain amount of posturing and kind of macho posing thing going on. These are 18-year-olds, first time away from mom and dad's house, probably. To make matters worse, the entire left side of the room is a set of bleachers where hundreds of young men sit waiting their turn and judging those of us who are swimming. So this is like a hothouse of male insecurity, right? Now, I was in one of the first heats, and so I get up like 3rd or 4th heat probably, so there were still plenty of people left in this jury of my peers over there. So I get up there and I sort of look to my right and I look to my left, and it's all these guys with their like bronzed Jersey Shore and Long Island bodies, and kind of looking down at my own pasty Midwest, Denny's Grand Slam body. And I'm thinking, this might not be pretty, but you know what? I don't care. All I have to do is finish. Doesn't matter. You don't have to be great. Just finish. So the whistle blows. In I jump. And I am booking because I want to keep up with the pack. And as the first lap kind of finishes up, I'm kind of like, toward the back of the middle of the pack of this crew. Make the turn into the second lap. And toward the end of the second lap, I'm noticing that I'm falling behind significantly from my peers who are swimming with me. And then I discover that the adrenaline that has been powering me thus far is used up. And I have no juice left at all. And all of a sudden, I went from powering through the water to crawling. And I made the turn into my third lap. And at some point, the instructors, they get tired of waiting for me, so they just send the next heat out, and I'm getting lapped by these people. And I'm into my third lap, and by about halfway through, I'm not noticing those people anymore, and I'm not noticing all the dudes in the bleachers watching me anymore, because at this point, this has become about survival, and I am not sure if I'm going to make it. Like, there's a real desperation that's sinking in, and the minutes tick on. This desperation turns to the panic of like a drowning animal, and my eyes are wide and crazy, and my arms are burning, and my lungs are burning, and all I'm doing is just like focused on that tiled wall at the end of the lane, and it's so far away, and I'm trying to close the distance, and it's 15 feet away, and then it's 5 feet away, and then finally, my fingertips brush the ceramic tile of the lip of the pool, and I grab on, and I know that I'm not going to die. So I go to hoist myself up out of the pool, and I discover that my arms are like made of mashed potatoes. There's just nothing there. I can't even lift myself out. So I have to just hang there, bobbing in the water for a couple minutes, trying to get my wits about me. And while I'm doing that, one of the instructors kind of comes by, and he looks down at me, and he says, "You all right?" "Yeah. You made it." "Uh-huh." So after a couple minutes, I get my strength back, and I'm able to haul myself up out of the pool, and I go into the men's locker room and sit down on the bench to kind of wait for my ears to stop ringing. And, at some point, I get up, and I throw up the contents of my rice cooker in the toilet, come sit down again. And gradually, I settle down. My heart slows down enough so that I can think again, and it starts to dawn on me that I finished this thing. I did it, and it wasn't pretty. But this is college, and nobody cares what grade you get. It just matters if you pass. So At some point, I'm feeling pretty good, and I collect my stuff, and I head down the hill back to my dorm, and with every step, I'm feeling prouder, and I decide to make a quick detour. So I break over to the campus store, and I take out my money, and I buy myself a baseball cap. It's a white cap. It's the kind that the sports teams wear, and it's got the school logo on it and stuff like that. And I would wear this hat almost every day of my freshman year because I was so proud. The hat said, Cornell Swim Team. Thank you.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're hearing stories from a live event in Seattle co-hosted by Sound Effect and Fresh Ground Stories. It was Ty Reed's story that first suggested the evening's theme to me, Small Miracles. Ty works in sales in Seattle, and he first told this story at a Fresh Ground Stories event. A warning, it deals with the subject of suicide. If you want to sit this one out, it's about 10 minutes long.
So I wasn't supposed to become a homeless drug addict and petty criminal. My family growing up was kind of like the Huxtables, if Theo really liked to smoke crack. And it really was my insistence on doing things my way that had landed me where I was. It turned me from a highly successful mortgage professional, very highly paid in 2006, and to a down-and-out homeless person in 2014. And really, bad decision-making was my downfall over and over again. Bad decisions about my money, about my girlfriends, about my associates and my activities had really led me down a bad road. As an example of some of the great decision-making that I would employ, in 2012, after 10 years of very hard drug use, I decided I no longer wanted to be the cliche black guy named Tyrone who smoked crack. And so I quit immediately and switched to meth. Breaking the color barrier there. So with decision making like that, obviously homelessness was the definite place I was going to end up. And now it's 2015, it's the summer. I've been homeless for about a year now. And I'm standing in a $400 a night hotel room in downtown Seattle that I've gotten by far less than honest means. And I'm alone. And this feeling of desperation and loneliness starts to wash over me. I pick up my phone and I text my friend who had just left the room, of course, to go get more drugs, and say, I won't be here when you get back. When she asks why, my response is simply, I'm tired. I can't do this anymore. I turn off my phone and I put on my backpack and I start to head towards the door. And as I do, I think back to just a couple of months earlier when, although God and I had always had a kind of a contentious relationship, I was in such a place of desperation that I actually prayed to God that my life would get better and get to look like something more normal somehow. And I wondered as I headed towards the door why those prayers had gone unanswered. How could a God who supposedly loved me so much forget about me? As I got to the elevator, I pushed the down button, and my thoughts turned to my family. And what will my family think when they find out that this one-time egomaniac, who was so concerned about how he looked and what people thought and his image, what will they think when they find out that he's dead because he walked himself into traffic in an obvious suicide? And we'd end up dead on the streets, underweight, haggard, and homeless. And I feel some pain for just a second, and only a second, because my thoughts turn back to me. This is my moment. I can't think about them. This is about me ending my pain and my shame and my guilt. As the elevator arrives, you know, it's summer, so it's air conditioned. So it's cold inside, and there's nobody in it. So it's cold and it's empty, just the way that I feel right at that moment. I get on the elevator and I push the down button. And as the elevator begins to descend, my plan becomes clearer in my head. Okay, fourth floor. I'll go out to the street. I'll smoke one of my last two cigarettes. Third floor. I watch traffic really, really carefully because I need to pick the right moment to dash into it. Second floor. It's got to be a big truck or an SUV because I don't want to get injured. I want to get ended. Lobby. Doors open. I make my way out to the sidewalk as quickly as I can. I take out my cigarette and I start to smoke. It is a beautiful summer Seattle Saturday night. The streets are electric. There are people walking, talking, laughing, connecting with each other. Something I had forgotten how to do long ago. Lots of cars on the street. I think to myself, lots of good chances here to do what I need to do. So I'm standing there. I'm about halfway through my cigarette, and I'm just looking out into traffic. And out of the corner of my eye, I see this person starting to approach me. And I looked at him, and he looked a little, looked kind of haggard, like I did. So I thought he might be homeless. Or since it's Seattle, he might have been a hipster. I wasn't sure which it was. But I thought he was going to come and ask me for my last cigarette, because on the streets of Seattle, I don't know if you know this, but you never smoke a pack alone. But instead of asking me for a cigarette, he asked me for help. And his story was this. He was an alcoholic. He'd been kicked out of his house by his wife. And he's staying at the Union Gospel Mission. Hasn't eaten in a couple of days. Can I help him out with some food? And I have the thought, well, I don't have any money, even though I'm staying in this very expensive hotel room. But I have some money on my food card. And you can't take it with you. Somebody might as well make use of it. So I agree to help him, and we start walking to a 7-Eleven just a couple of blocks away. He's trying to engage me in conversation. What's your name, he says. I say, doesn't matter anymore. Where do you live? I don't live anywhere, but that doesn't matter anymore. And he's starting to get a sense that maybe there's something larger going on with me, so he falls silent for a few seconds. And then he says something that, quite frankly, shocks me. He turns and says, you know God has a plan for you, right? I kind of go blank for a couple of seconds. And I turn and look at him, and I say, it doesn't matter what God's plan is. I can't do this anymore. I'm tired. And I turn away so he can't see me starting to tear up. We get to the 7-Eleven. I go in the store. I buy him whatever I can. And I exit very quickly, even though he's still trying to talk to me or engage with me in some way, because I felt like I still had to do what I had to do, and nothing was going to stop that. And when I get out to the sidewalk, streets that mere moments before were busy, bustling, with lots of people and lots of traffic, are empty. Now, when I say the street was empty, I don't mean there's a couple of people walking around, there's a couple of cars moving down the street. I mean there's absolutely no people. And there's no cars. This strikes me as very odd. So I walk up to the cross street and I look up and down. No people, no cars. Under my breath, I say, are you effing kidding me? I take out my last cigarette, I sit on the sidewalk, and I start to smoke. And I say to myself, I guess tonight is not the night that I die. Now, in the movie of my life, starring Will Smith, likely directed by Spike Lee, this would be the moment when the clouds will part. I will learn all my lessons, and the very next day I will turn my life around. Unfortunately for me, my life is not a movie. And quite frankly, I hadn't had enough punishment yet. Life had not kicked my butt enough for me to have learned my lessons. But luckily for me, in just a few more months, I'd had enough. And I was able to start making some positive change in my life. Often people will ask me, how did you make such a monumental change? Going from someone who was sleeping in stolen hotel rooms, or under a bridge, or getting high and not sleeping at all and just walking all night, to someone who is gainfully employed, has the love of his friends and family, and is actually a productive member of society. There's a lot of things that I could point to, but two things stand out very strongly for me. Number one, having had the opportunity to live in a sober home. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with sober homes, these are safe, stable environments where people like me who need to get in recovery and stay away from drugs and alcohol can live to reestablish their lives. It was incredibly instrumental in me being able to lead a life that was somewhat normal. And these are very important places for folks. Number two, I am irritatingly optimistic. I see the best of everything, and I tend to live my life in gratitude, and I focus on the things that I have instead of what I don't. And quite frankly, while most days it would be nice to have a million more dollars and be 3% body fat, the fact is that I have more than what I need, and I'm really grateful for what I have. One of the other things I'm also grateful for is the opportunity to have been here with you tonight. So thank you so much for listening and attending.
Ty Reed works in Seattle. You're listening to a special broadcast of Sound Effect from KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today you're hearing our live storytelling event, which was co-produced with Seattle-based Fresh Ground Stories. Cindy Healy is a manager at Microsoft, but her story of small miracles comes from outer space. Here she is.
Okay, so I was at the movies. My husband was on my right, my teenage son was on my left, and good old Matt Damon was up on the big screen. And he was stranded on Mars. Oh my gosh, no one on Earth even realizes he's alive. What is he going to do? So he gets in his Mars car and he starts driving across the planet. Where is he going? I don't know. I haven't read the book or anything. And then he gets out of his Mars car and he starts digging. And that's when it hits me, and I know what he's digging for. And the tears just start flowing down my cheeks. And I'm trying hard to suppress an audible sob because I know I am the only one crying at this part of the movie. And I'm just wiping away tears, and my son looks at me like I'm crazy. And I lean over to him and I whisper, "That's my spacecraft." You see, I'm one of a few hundred people on this planet that put that spacecraft, Mars Pathfinder, up there in real life so Matt Damon could dig her up in the movies. So Pathfinder was basically a bet between NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to see just how fast and how cheap we could put something on another planet. We had minimal budget. I mean, we were a joke. People around the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or the lab, didn't even want to work on it. They thought it would ruin their careers. They thought it was doomed for failure. Literally, the joke around the lab was, for $200 million, we were trying to land a spacecraft and a rover on Mars for less money than Kevin Costner had just spent on Waterworld. So we were a lean team. We didn't have a lot of money, right? So we were a lean team. We were super empowered, though. That meant that if you did well in one area, you got additional responsibilities. So a lot of us got to wear a lot of different hats. So my first hat, my primary hat, was writing simulation code. Code that would fake the spacecraft out and make it think it was either flying to Mars or doing operations on the surface of Mars, when in fact it was right there in our lab in Pasadena. I'm particularly proud of some code that my buddy Miguel and I wrote that helped perfect the flight navigation system. Code that is still being used on Mars missions today. Because you know what they call a spacecraft that doesn't have perfect flight navigation? Space crap. A little space humor. So my second hat that I got to wear was writing uplink code so that we could send all kinds of messages to the spacecraft, including rewriting the whole code base if we needed to. So at one point, I had to fill this huge data buffer with extra characters as placeholders. So I had to put anything I wanted to in that data buffer, so I put all the names of those of us on the software team. So my name was in every transmission that went from Earth to Mars for the entire mission. Hundreds and thousands of messages. So when the Martians finally do come to Earth, they're going to be looking for me. And then my third hat, the hat that remained elusive, the hat that I so desperately wanted, was to be selected to be a member of the launch team. So this was a team of about 25 people that would go live on Cocoa Beach and work at the Kennedy Space Center and put the spacecraft together for the final assembly and testing. It was a 2-month gig on the beach, and I had to get on that launch team list. I was on the bubble, I was on the nice to have list with my role in simulation, but I was not on the must have list. And all my best Pathfinder buddies were going. I had to get my name on the list. So one day my coworker Ron, our Unix system administrator, he lamented to me that he was on the list, but he didn't want to go. His wife was having a baby and the timing was all wrong and she was going to kill him. And I saw my opportunity and I said, I'll do it. You can train me how to be the Unix system administrator. How hard could it be? And I'll go in your place. And he actually liked the idea. And we sold it to management. And the next thing you know, I'm at Cape Kennedy, unpacking boxes, laying cables under the floor, formatting and configuring those Unix machines as if I knew what I was doing as the Unix system administrator. So on the night of the launch, my buddy Becky and I were about 20 minutes late getting to our outpost building where we would do the final countdown, because we had stopped to take a selfie on the launch pad with the rocket, of course, right? We were ahead of our time on selfies. And when I get to the outpost building, everyone's looking around and waiting for me and looking kind of pissed off and giving me a stink eye, like I'm late or something, and that's, I'm all, what's the big deal? Well, we had no communications back to JPL. We were dead in the water, not the least bit of a signal. This could cost us the launch, and this was a job for the Unix system administrator. So I panicked just a little bit, right? Talk about imposter syndrome. I literally wasn't really a Unix system administrator, but I had pretty much just been faking it for a few weeks. And so, but I thought back to my training from Ron, and I had pages and pages of notes, and the first thing that he had said was, always check the cables, make sure everything is plugged in. So with all eyes upon me, I went to the back of every machine and I checked every cable and every plug, and then I would just work my way to the next piece of equipment and I would check every cable and every plug. And thank God I worked my way to the corner of the room where our Cisco router was, and sure enough, a cable was loose. And I jiggled that baby back in and we were back online, and I was a hero as the Unix system administrator. So we went on to have a fantastic launch that night, and then we had an incredible flight to Mars for 7 months, and then amazing operations on the surface of Mars. Pathfinder lasted for over 3.5 months, sending all kinds of pictures and telemetry and data back to those of us on Earth. She lasted for 3.5 months, even though we only expected her to last for a few weeks, so she way outlived her expectations. And she really set the bar and set a new path, like she was supposed to do, for interplanetary space travel, and such that all these missions that we read about in the news today are leveraging her code and building upon her legacy. And that will include future missions that put people on Mars. So I'm so happy and thrilled to have been a part of this little piece of history. And it has meant so much to me in my life then, and then in my life now, when I get to retell the story. I learned so many things. I learned to ignore doubters and people who say you can't do it, and people who are not rooting for you to succeed. I learned to take on risks, say yes to things, volunteer even when I have no idea what I'm doing. And I learned to always check the cables.
Cindy Healy is a former NASA engineer. She currently works at Microsoft and is a veteran live storyteller. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and we're listening to the live event we put on with Fresh Ground Stories. The theme is Small Miracles. Queen Mae Butters is a witness to those miracles all the time because of her job. Queen is a hospice nurse, meaning she cares for people at the end of their lives. She's found that dying isn't always bleak and sad and full of suffering. Because death is universal, it can be a time of unique and precious connection. Here's the story of one of those connections between Queen and Rose.
I called Rose on a Wednesday to introduce myself as her hospice nurse. This week, she had been diagnosed with liver cancer and declined any treatment options. Her doctor had referred her to our home hospice. Hi, Rose. My name is Queen Butters. I'm a nurse with home hospice. There is a long pause, some swallowing sounds, and then I hear her say, "Okay, listen, I'm new to dying. I've been getting a lot of calls today when I usually get none. Guess what else? Can you believe someone is trying to steal my identity at the same time I have cancer? I have to get used to all this. Who did you say you are? Some kind of butter?" No, my first name is actually Queen and my last name is Butters. I'm a registered nurse that comes to your home and visits you weekly. Rose says, "Well, isn't this a kick? I'm gonna die, someone wants my identity, and I have a nurse named Queen." Her apartment is on the sixth floor of a walk-up near Alphabet City, the Lower East Side of Manhattan. The first time I walk up her steps, I stop at the fourth floor, already planning to hand her care off to a nurse who is more spry, who can walk up those stairs weekly without complaining. Then I hear Rose's twangy New York accent encouraging me from above. "You're gonna make it, nurse. You're almost here. Keep climbing." Rose held out her arms to help me up the last few steps. Her abdomen was round as if it held a 6 month pregnancy, her skin yellowing like a peach. Rose grabs my hands, pulling me up the last few steps into her embrace. There she is, like some kind of old friend, holding me up with her yellow arms as I catch my breath enough to introduce myself. Her apartment is a two-room studio with a kitchen and a teeny tiny bathroom. Her bed is in the first room. There is a dining table serving as her desk and an office chair with a big computer her workplace had loaned her. She tells me the second room in her apartment is a closet and a guest area, adding, "But I don't have too many guests anymore." What I notice is the way her apartment is lit in the middle, holding the light like a temple. Rose collects broken glass, glass prisms, and broken shards of colored glass from the streets of the East Village. She collects glass she finds and glues it to her windows. These windows directly face the dirty bricks of the building next door. Sunlight coming through the old bottles and mashed ashtrays feels like stained glass windows on every wall. She sits on her bed. I sit on the office chair. I can see how tired she is. Her morning has been spent talking to detectives about her stolen identity and getting deliveries and visits from her new hospice team, which she had not understood to be a home service that comes to her, that she doesn't have to go anywhere. She has been a healthy, strong woman ascending six floors of stairs for 20 years in her cozy little East Village life. Despite the cancer and her swollen abdomen, she tells me, "I'm perfectly healthy." "I'm lucky," she announces, "because for the last 2 years, I've been following a practice where the day I'm in is my last one. Like the Buddhists say, I'm ready," she says. "I just don't know how it's gonna go down. That's where I need help." She points to her abdomen with her thin little arms. The doctor had told her if she took chemo and radiation, she would live 2 to 3 months longer than if she was just to let the disease run its course. She said, "I've lived over 50 years. I've been happy. I'm just gonna have to see what happens, like I've always done." I visit Rose weekly, adjusting her medications so she is comfortable, safe, and pooping. We start Rose on oral steroids to help increase her energy and appetite. She says to me one visit, "Queen, I know what those pills you are that you got me. They are drugs, plain and simple. like the speed and ecstasy we used to take at the bars. I can feel how it speeds up my mind and makes me think I'm right about everything. Rose has spent the better part of her time in the East Village as a barfly. She had lost her taste for vodka and whiskey by the time I met her, but she told me stories of friendships that came and went depending on where she was drinking. Years ago, Rose drank with a gay man from Brazil who needed citizenship. Long before the Immigration Service caught on to fake marriages for green cards, she married him for convenience and money. He got his green card. She got $5,000. Their friendship ended, she said, because they had had a fight. Rose says, "Can't remember what the fight was about. I'm not good at fixing things after I get mad." Her ex-husband had heard that Rose had fallen ill. He called her up. Neither one could remember why they fought or why they stopped being friends. He told her he left the bars to study Zen Buddhism with a Zen Sangha in the Soho. He asked Rose if his teacher could come and visit. He said, "Maybe you would want to learn some meditation that might help you with your death." Rose tells me, "I have always tried everything, so why stop now?" The Zen teacher came wearing a black robe and thick, heavy leather shoes. He changed out of the shoes for black socks with a space sewn in just for his big toe. He taught Rose to sit through her fear and stay calm. They would end the meditation, ring the bell, and then both would light up cigarettes. "I trusted him immediately when I saw his pack of camels," Rose said. The Zen teacher enjoyed Rose and visited often to teach, meditate, and smoke with her in her sixth-floor walk-up. A room at the hospice residence opened just as Rose was declining and falling asleep with lit cigarettes in her bed. Rose had her friends nail her paintings up on the walls of her room at the hospice and replace the table lamps with her own lamps. She lived a few weeks at the inpatient hospice, her body becoming heavier with fluids. She stopped being able to eat and eventually drink. I sat with Rose the evening before the morning of her death. It was pitch black outside. There was a thunder and lightning storm. Rose's room had a killer view of the East River and beyond. She is on her side, facing away from the window, facing towards me. I am sitting next to her, my hand on her body, feeling her breathe move through her, watching the sky pop with light after every thunder crash. Rose had been quiet after kissing my hand when I arrived. Her eyes are closed and she is not talking. One thunder crash arouses her and she says, "Queen, I don't want to die. Is this dying? I'm not ready. I have so much more." Her voice drifts off. I'm always at a loss at what to say in these instances because I do not know what is comforting. I close my eyes and I see Rose standing at the top of her steps, peering down at me that first day we met, encouraging me to make it all the way up. I remember all the mischief and beauty she had created in her apartment and in the little Manhattan village that was her place. "Rose, do what you have always done. Gather your resources and go forward. I love you no matter what you do. I love you, Rose." She squeezes my hand and goes back to the quiet place. I left her side when the Zen teacher arrived around 11 p.m., both of us loyal stewards to a woman we met mere months before. He sits with her all night, meditating, tells her he wants to be awake with her when she dies. They were together. She died in the early morning when the sun was just beginning to shine over her East Village. Thank you.
Queen Mae Butters is a hospice nurse and a writer.
Thank you, Queen.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're spinning stories today from our live storytelling event in Seattle. Our partner for that thing was Paul Currington, founder of Fresh Ground Stories. He's told many, many tales on stage over the years, and this is one he says he tends to avoid. But he shared it at our urging, and I am so, so lucky he did. Here's Paul's story of small miracles.
It's 2007, and I'm sitting on a gurney in the ER with a mask on my face, and I'm trying to breathe. I've been there a while, and it's not getting any better. I always knew I had asthma, but I never had it so bad that I had to go to the hospital. And as I'm sitting there trying to breathe, I know two things for sure. One is that this is what it feels like to die. And two, that the spirit of my late mother is there beside me. And as I'm sitting there, I really have one thought going through my head over and over again. It's, please God, please don't let my last thoughts on earth be of my mother. Because my mother smoked every day of my childhood, 2 or 3 packs a day inside the house. I remember coming home from school and I would see my mom sitting at the kitchen table every day just enveloped in clouds of smoke. It was as though somebody had just rubbed a magic lamp and an angry coughing genie popped out who was in the mood to grant no wishes. Because you see, my mother also had a volcanic temper and I spent most of my life hiding. Hiding in the house, hiding in the woods, hiding at school. I would do anything to not have to go home so I wouldn't have to show up in her crosshairs. It's hard. But the thing I hated most, the thing I couldn't hide from, was the smoke. And I hated that smoke, man. I hated that we stunk. I hated that when I was a little kid, she used to send me down the street to the Bi-Lo with a signed note that says, please sell my son Paul 2 packs of Viceroy cigarettes. This was back in the day when you could get anything with a signed note from your mom. You could get cigarettes, whiskey, handgun, plutonium. It didn't make you get anything with a signed note from your mom. What I hated most was that I knew she was killing herself. Because it was just me and her, and if anything happened to her, I was on the street, man. That's what it was. And then one day when I was 17, I came home from school. She was sitting at that kitchen table enveloped in the smoke. And she had this weird look on her face. I'd never seen it before. So I said, Ma, what's going on? And she didn't say anything. I said, Ma, you all right? And somehow she communicated that she was unable to speak. I didn't know what to do, so I called a cab. Neither of us knew how to drive. And I took her to the hospital where a doctor told us that the cancer that had started in her lungs, that we didn't know anything about, had moved into her head and had eaten away the part of the brain that controls speech. And in the month and a half it took her to die, my mother didn't say a word. It was the scariest and strangely the calmest month and a half of my life. And when she finally did die, 6 weeks later, this change came over me. Suddenly, I wasn't afraid to tell my mother how I felt about things. So a few years later, when my son was born and she wasn't there to see it, I told her how I felt about that. And a few years later, when I was in my 30s and I reconnected with my dad and I found out a bunch of stuff at our family and what he had to deal with, I told her what I felt about that. I was winning every argument with my mom. It was awesome. It was fantastic. I loved it. Until that night in the ER, man, where her spirit rose up. And as I sat there gasping for breath, I could smell those cigarettes, and I could hear her coughing, and I could hear all those things she used to say to me. And I was mad. I thought I left that all in the past. Well, I finally left the ER with a new inhaler, but I decided I was going to change. I didn't want to feel that way ever again, so I started working out. I was going to work on my lungs. So I started lifting weights. I started doing my cardio. I ran a half marathon. And every time when I was training, when I got short of breath, I would smell those cigarettes, and I would hear that coughing, and I would hear all those things she used to say to me, and I would get up, and I would run twice as fast. I would run twice as fast and twice as far away as I could go to get away from that. And I did that for 10 years. And then one day, about a year and a half ago, for some reason, I decided I would start meditating. I don't know why. I hear it's good for you. And I remember The first time I did it, I sat down on the floor of my bedroom and I put the little earbuds in my ear and I hit play on the guided meditation. And this little man came over the headphones and he said, "Today we are going to focus on our breath." I said, "No, we are not focusing on our breath. I've spent 10 years avoiding my breath, trying not to breathe. I don't want to think about my breath anymore." However, I did spend 99 cents on the app, and I am going to get my money's worth. So I finished the meditation. And the next day, I did it again. The next day, I did another meditation. And those days turned into a week, and that week turned into a month, and that month turned into 6 months. And then one day, during the summer, I was sitting on my couch and I started wheezing. I don't know what was going on. I guess it was a high pollen count. I was having what I call a bad air day. And so I ran out of my apartment because the thing that helps my asthma the most, and I don't know why this is walking up hills. My doctor doesn't understand it. I don't understand it. I guess it just forces air into me. I don't know why. So I started walking up this long, steep hill behind my house. And when I started walking up this thing, I'm starting to wheeze and I'm starting to gas because it's a really steep hill, and I can smell those cigarettes and I can hear that cough and I can hear my mom and all those things she used to say, and I start running up that hill, man. I'm running as fast as I can to get away from that, and I'm running up this hill faster than I've ever gone before, and I get to the top of that hill and for some reason, I'm breathing deeper than I've ever breathed before. I'm feeling parts of my lungs that I have never felt. I'm actually tasting oxygen. And in that moment, I realize my mother hasn't spoken to me in 35 years. That voice that I've been arguing with all this time, that's me. That's my voice. And if I want to, I can stop this right now because I don't live in that house anymore. So from then on, whenever I get to the top of some long, steep hill, the only voice I hear in my head is the one that says, "You made it. You're free. You can breathe now." Thank you so much, everyone, for coming out and supporting us. Good night, everyone.
Paul Currington is the founder of Fresh Ground Stories and co-producer of our storytelling event. He lives in Olympia. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Thanks also to Aaron Hennessy and Kari Ploeg. Our intern is Max Wasserman, and our executive producer is Matt Martinez. We had a ton of help putting this event together, starting with my partner in crime, Paul Currington. If you've never checked out Fresh Ground Stories, it runs on the third Thursday of every month at the Olive Way Starbucks in Seattle. Special thanks to Brenda Goldstein-Young, Adrian Flores, and Eric Hanberg here at CanKX, as well as to our venue, The Collective. And thanks to our tellers, including Ty Green, Cindy Healy, and Queen May Butters. Subscribe to our podcast if you haven't already, and come on back next week when our theme will be City Slickers. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.